Hello and welcome to Ukraine Calling, your weekly review of what's been happening in Ukraine with a focus on a main issue. I'm Andrei Kulikov for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and here's a look at some of the stories that were in the news this week.
Today's lull in fighting came as President Trump pledged to help bring peace to the region. Trump phoned Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko on Saturday, telling him he would, quote, work with Ukraine, Russia, and all other parties involved to help restore peace.
I was one of the first world leaders to whom President Trump called immediately after the election, and we have quite a promising conversation.
السلام عليكم مشاهدينا الكرام نشرة الأخبار من قناة UATV الأوكرانية بالعاصمة كييف أصحابكم فيها أنا محمد زاوي والبداية بأبرز العناوين.
Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko had his first phone conversation with the US President Donald Trump on Saturday, the 4th of February. After the call, the White House released a statement which said that Mr. Trump had a very good call with Poroshenko and the two presidents addressed a variety of topics. According to the White House statement, President Trump said, "We will work with Ukraine, Russia, and all other parties involved to help them restore peace along the border." The Ukrainian president's press secretary reported that the two leaders are ready to explore additional steps to enhance the strategic partnership between Ukraine and the United States, and that Ukraine's Poroshenko focused on the need to achieve peace in the Donbas, intensify economic and business ties, and discussed a forthcoming visit to the US. Another Ukrainian political leader, Yulia Tymoshenko, has already reportedly met with Mr. Trump in Washington. Politico ran a story on this with the headline, "Trump won't lift sanctions against Russia." Later in the show, Marta Dichok interviews Politico Europe's managing editor Matthew Kaminsky about the Trump-Tymoshenko story, journalism in the age of information warfare, and Ukraine's place within the changing international landscape more broadly. This week, Ukraine got a new national police chief. Serhiy Knyazev was appointed by the Cabinet of Ministers, Ukraine's government, on Wednesday, the 8th of February. Knyazev was promoted to the top police job from being the head of the country's criminal investigation department. There were mixed reactions to this appointment. He is reportedly a good manager, but he has worked within Ukraine's police system for many years, and the system is plagued by corruption. The previous police chief, Georgian-born Hatia Dekonoidze, had quit the position last November, saying that her reform and anti-corruption efforts were being thwarted from within. Crimean Tatars who remained on the occupied peninsula now have easier access to a new information source. Ukraine's international broadcaster, UATV, has been producing news in Crimean Tatar language for a while. This past week, they increased their broadcast signal strength by switching to the Hotbird satellite frequency. Now UATV can broadcast into Crimea, as well as much of Europe. They also broadcast online. We will post a link to their website on ours. Ukraine's Institute of National Memory submitted a bill to Parliament which would introduce changes to holiday celebration. A modernization and further de-Sovietization. The bill proposes to reduce the overall number of official holidays from 11 to 9. This would decrease the long holiday breaks that are a leftover from the Soviet era. March the 9th is proposed as a new Taras Shevchenko Day to honor Ukraine's most famous poet. This would be instead of marking March the 8th as International Women's Day, something that was introduced during the Soviet era. The 9th of May will remain as the official day of victory over Nazism, and the 8th of May is the day of commemoration and reconciliation, something the INM proposed a few years ago. For those of you who understand Ukrainian, you can listen to Громадське радіо's interview with the Institute's director, Володимир В'ятрович, on the link we will post for you. The intensity of shelling began to decrease in Ukraine's war zone on Sunday, the 5th of February, whereas on Saturday, three Ukrainian soldiers were killed and eight wounded. Starting on Sunday and for the rest of the week, there were no more casualties. However, 15 more were wounded, and civilian targets continued to be shelled heavily. The OSCE's special monitoring mission released a table of ceasefire violations in English, Ukrainian, and Russian, with all the details. If you are interested, you will find a link to the report on our website.
Matthew Kaminsky is the executive editor of Politico's European edition, and he took that position in 2015. Before that, he was working as an editor with the Wall Street Journal. And before that, he was actually working in Kyiv for the Financial Times. So Mr. Kaminsky has a perspective that's quite unique in that he's lived in Ukraine, he's lived in the States, and now he's based in Brussels for observing international affairs as a journalist. There are few better places to do that. We reached Mr. Kaminsky in Brussels. Thank you very much for finding the time to join us. I'd like to start with asking, in this changing European and global landscape with the new American president, Brexit, elections coming up in Germany and France, where do you see Ukraine fitting into this picture?
It's a confused picture to begin with. And if there's confusion in Ukraine or about Ukraine, it is a confusion that I think is shared globally about sort of, you know, where we are and where we're headed. What is striking to me about the current current place we find ourselves in human history is that for so long we were always able to kind of hold on to something that would give us some sense of certainty about, well, this is what the current order is. This is the sort of the role the U.S. plays in it. This is the role that, you know, institutions like NATO and the EU play in it. Those sort of rails you could hold on to are gone. And I think if everyone feels they're a bit in free fall, I sense that's sort of widely, widely shared. And that especially applies to Ukraine, which I think until certainly before the Maidan revolution starting in late 2013, and even until, let's say, 2 months ago, there was a sort of sense of where Ukraine fit into the international sort of puzzle, that it was a country which was slowly but kind of surely getting closer and closer to the institutions of the West, namely EU, maybe a bit less NATO, although Ukrainians certainly wanted to go toward NATO. With Brexit, you've essentially kind of called into question whether the EU is even going to be around in 5 years. With what happened after the Maidan, with the annexation of Crimea, Putin, namely, has called into question whether the old rules of the way we handle relations within Europe, you know, that borders are respected, that wars are a relic of a different century, that was out the window. And I think with Trump, you have even raised much bigger questions about this sort of European order, which was for over 70 years now guaranteed by the U.S. And I think we're just really, it's too soon to tell if this dust is going to settle or whether you're going to get more uncertainty and more kind of disruption and possibly destruction of institutions, perhaps of countries in the months and years to come.
One of the headlines in Politico that ran in January, Donald Trump's win shakes Ukraine. And there's an article that I think very aptly captures that Ukraine is now feeling like it's worried to face Russia on its own. I wanted to ask you about Politico. In this world where information warfare has become the norm and the lines between fact and fiction have been increasingly blurred, Politico is striving to maintain old standards of journalism. What are some of the challenges your media organization is facing in doing this?
Well, I think in a way, this sort of debate about fake news is a bit on. I mean, I think there's been fake news for a very long time, almost as long as you've had news. You know, you had the yellow press has been around. I think the difference now is that, you know, you can get this stuff to people directly and faster and with a kind of almost unrelenting intensity than ever before. Which I find kind of almost amusing, if it wasn't so slightly disturbing, is that the people who are now kind of yelling and screaming about fake news, including in the new team in the White House, were the same people who were, you know, sort of peddling stories 2 years ago that Barack Obama is a kind of, you know, a Muslim born in Saudi Arabia or in Indonesia. So I think that that's the debate about fake news seems not as new as we think it is. I think, you know, the kind of quality brands in journalism, it's been actually, if not in business terms, but certainly in its impact, what have been the most influential, media brands that have done well during the campaign and covering, news overseas? It's the names that you are familiar with for a long time. It's the New York Times. It's probably CNN. I think, with all due modesty, I think Politico kind of figures in. And that's because I think we all try and do our jobs the way that we were taught to do our jobs, you know, whether 10, 20, 30 years ago, which is that we, report fairly. We put a premium on accuracy. And getting the story right is the most important thing about the story. I think the challenges are actually not, I think the sort of the habits of a good newsroom are mostly unchanged. A couple of challenges. There's a small challenge, which is the sort of speed of modern media, and that's obviously different. You know, in the old days, we thought that putting out a daily newspaper was incredibly stressful, and every 24 hours you had to, you know, think of layout, put together a kind of, you know, a publication. Now you're doing it live all the time. So sometimes I think with speed is when you tend to get into trouble. But again, you know, we've had radio and news wires for over 100 years now, and that's not new. Speed is not new. Live news is not something new. I think the bigger challenge to us is, one, it's the unrelenting attacks by people in power who try and discredit you all the time, whether it's Trump yelling about fake media or it's the Kremlin or RT putting stuff out there, pretending that it's media. In fact, it's actually a kind of government propaganda outlet that helps discredit sort of media. And you see it in all the sort of poll numbers. The sort of trust in media has fallen dramatically ever since Watergate. There was a slight blip up, and then since then it's been kind of going down. But trust in all public institutions in the democratic world has been falling at a much the sort of same rate. You know, we always joke in, you know, that in America, the media is as trusted, it has the same approval ratings as the U.S. Congress, meaning that it's very, very, very low. And I don't quite know what to do about that. I think it seems to be more of a function of the times we live in, where our political culture is generally, and media is a sort of player in that culture. But, you know, in the same ways that politicians aren't very much trusted, the media isn't trusted. But I would say that sort of, you know, the kind of the sort of, at least the media that's committed to quality journalism is doing better work than ever before. And I think it's doing better work than ever before in a more hostile environment to the media. And I guess as an editor, our reaction is, well, you know, we have the standards we have. We are have a commitment to the kind of journalism that we put out. And you just, you know, take the heat as it comes from the kitchen. But we also know there's an audience that relies on you, that does trust you, and that does respect, what we do.
The audience, that's the point that I wanted to get to. The most read articles, the most recent webpage of yours The audience is also partly a driver in this. The most read article this week or today is Theresa May jokes about Donald Trump's hands. So I think one of the challenges you guys are facing is how to present serious information and yet also deal with the fact that people follow these kind of fluffy stories. Some of my students actually have been using your political reporting on Ukraine, and that's the next thing I wanted to talk about is Ukraine is not the biggest story in the world these days and in Politico, and yet Politico sometimes gets the big headlines. The one that caught many people's attention was Trump tells Ukrainian politician it won't lift Russia sanctions. How did you guys get that scoop? Because that was the Tymoshenko having a meeting with Trump. You guys are in Brussels. So how did you guys get that? And well, again, a little bit of your coverage.
I'm not going to reveal exactly how this sausage is made, but there are tricks to trade. But we're a global publication.
Yes.
We have, you know, we part of our expansion into Europe 2 years ago was a concerted push overseas, and so what we did is we, set up, and we're in Brussels is where we're headquartered, but we have people in. Obviously, London, Paris, Berlin, Frankfurt, and so on. But we have a sort of a good contributor in Kiev, and we have people. We have a huge operation in Washington, where one of the reporters, Ken Vogel, has done a lot of stories in sort of campaigns on campaign financing. And at some point last year, he got interested in Paul Manafort. Paul Manafort, as you know, was working for Viktor Yanukovych. Yes. That got him interested in the Ukrainian story, and one thing led to another, and I think we sort of got a, we were able to stand up a story that in a meeting with Tymoshenko, Trump was apparently charmed and told her that, you know, he would keep the sanctions in place, and that's been a message that's been repeated by his UN ambassador, Nikki Haley, and most recently yesterday by the White House spokesman. As long as Russia is in Crimea, the sanctions will remain in place. But, you know, it's actually, I mean, and you mentioned, you know, just getting back to your sort of previous comment about the sort of top 10 list, that is kind of a bit of a popularity contest, but that's not, I don't look at that very often, to be honest. It's, we're not, and I think any media today, if you're just about traffic, if you're just about people coming to your site, then you're in the wrong business. Because if you're about traffic, you should be Google or Facebook and find ways to, you know, make money off it. The way that our business works is that we are putting out authoritative, must-read political coverage that people who are in that world, that political world, feel they have to read. And because those people are hooked to our journalism, that's how we're able to make this work commercially. So journalism is not a popularity contest, but, you know, we do put out stories out there that are a bit lighter because readers might want to click on a Theresa May, Donald Trump's hands story, but they'll also read the Ukraine sanctions story. And I mean, this newsroom is overwhelmingly sort of committed to serious, bordering on wonky reporting.
Mm-hmm. And the headlines sometimes is that perhaps a way of bridging the gap? Because another story that received a lot of attention was the headline, Ukraine's efforts to sabotage Trump backfire. And it was the story about Manafort that you've already referred to, but it was the mm-hmm. article was very serious, but the headline was a little bit eye-catching, if we can use that term.
Well, I think the headline was a good headline. I mean, I think it kind of reflected what the story said and found. And, you know, a story, I mean, headlines are there to get people to read it without trying to fool them into making it seem like it's if they get fooled by a headline, they won't come back to your site. So we are very careful about that. But in the digital space, especially, much more so than a printed page, you have to. You are competing for people's attention. You know, the key thing is you want them to come to your headline. If they see something that sounds interesting, and something they would be interested in, then they click it. And then even the way we write the stories is they're written differently than I used to write stories when I was a print journalist, where I assumed I had someone's attention, not undivided, but certainly concentrated, you know, and they were holding that newspaper in their hands.
Mm.
Here you're looking at someone who's got a phone in their hands, and with the headline, with the way that you structure the story, you got to keep that person in, because the easiest thing for them to do is first of all, not to click, but then is to click away.
Well, getting attention, this is something that I think Ukraine's President Poroshenko is struggling to do internationally, not only with the media, but also with politicians. You know Ukraine very well. You know the United States well. You know Europe very well. Can I get your thoughts on what you think Poroshenko could be doing, should be doing, where Ukraine is actually headed, and where you see Ukraine in the next few months, perhaps in the next year?
So I haven't been back to Ukraine for more than a little bit. So I think my impressions are very much as someone who cares deeply about what is going on there, but hasn't sort of checked in with the domestic politics for a while. So I'm basing this on the impressions that I have out here. Mm-hmm.
That's the valuable Ukraine perspective, because you can see it from the outside.
I will try and bring that here. It's my impression that Ukraine really needs to fight for, you can use the word attention, of the new administration, attention of the Europeans. And there are two main partners. Both the Americans and the Europeans are incredibly distracted by other big, big problems. You know, whereas Ukraine had the undivided attention of the world in spring of 2014, even into 2015, but then it started to fade. Now, it is very hard for Ukraine to compete, even though none of the problems that were raised by what happened 2 years ago have been solved. You still have a not-so-cold war in eastern Ukraine. You still have Crimea, kind of sore point. You still have, you know, the sort of problems domestically in terms of there's this sort of problem in Ukraine for the last 25 years, which is how do you reform a country when your political class is as corrupt and as resistant to change as Ukraine's is, with some notable exceptions. This government is clearly an improvement on the previous government, but it hasn't gone as far as many people, including especially in Ukraine, would have hoped that it went. So there's a bit of, I think, a Ukraine fatigue, which is even what's even more dangerous is sort of Ukraine apathy. And Ukraine apathy in Washington and Brussels that is brought on by it being kind of sidelined by much bigger things in the minds of the Europeans. So here, for the Europeans, the problem is the rise of populism in their own countries. It's very important elections coming up in France, Germany, Netherlands, and definitely Italy, almost definitely Italy. It is Brexit. You know, the sort of the dismantling of the European Union and this kind of Western order. In the U.S., the attention is on whatever Donald Trump is tweeting in the last half hour, last 10 minutes. And when it comes to Ukraine's part of the world, you have a president who clearly doesn't much care, doesn't much know, except for some reason he hasn't. He's got this respect for Vladimir Putin and for Russia. You know, people speculate where that comes from. But where it does leave Ukraine is that it is not a priority. And if anything, this administration seems inclined to not even take it into account as it is thinking about moving ahead with Putin and Russia. I guess there's some good news here is that because there's really no one, you now have Rex Tillerson, but they are so consumed by learning how to govern. And in some ways, so consumed by all the domestic problems that I'm not sure they can even move on anything if they wanted to with the Russians. But the danger there for Ukraine is a bit different. I think one danger is that Ukraine will be sold out, right? It'll be part of some grand bargain. And sort of Putin takes advantage of having a president in the U.S. who really, for some reason, wants to get along with him. And certainly doesn't want to defend Ukraine. The other danger is that you have a president that's so weak and distracted in Washington that this is where Putin starts testing. And I have no idea how the fighting restarted in eastern Ukraine. I have no idea if it's sort of really if the blame is more on the, you know, the rebels or on the Ukrainian side. But it is very telling that this happened within 2 weeks of Trump taking office. And I think the real challenge that you had with Obama, a president who already wasn't all that willing to stick his neck out to help Ukraine. But at least there you had John Kerry at state, Joe Biden as vice president, Ash Carter at the Pentagon. You had Toria Nuland at the Department of State in a less senior job. These were all friends of Ukraine, advocates for Ukraine, Those people are all gone.
Except for McCain.
McCain. He's in the Senate, but he's sort of fighting, you know, he's fighting many other battles. Mm-hmm. But he is fighting the Ukraine battle. But, I think Ukraine doesn't have advocates anymore inside government. Mm-hmm. And in Brussels, it doesn't really have any friends. The Poles are used to be close friends, but I think now they're, again, kind of obsessed by what's happening internally. And they have their own problems here in the EU. The Germans have other priorities. The Hungarians are, you know, Vladimir's very close friends. So it's a very, very worrying situation internationally if you're thinking about it from a Ukrainian point of view.
Well, that's a very sober, realistic assessment. I was going to try to tease you out on how you see the end game, but you've laid out all the factors. I don't know if you would like to speculate where you see this ending and if you see this ending, or is this just going to be a continuation of uncertainty with all these factors moving in different ways?
I think one thing I have learned, and everyone should have learned about 2016, is do not make predictions, right? Because yeah. we'd all be broke or worse if we put any money on. Yeah, exactly. So, I think it's still fluid. I do think fundamentally, I'm still puzzled why a country like Russia, which is economically backward, politically frozen, has nothing really to offer to anyone, is able to sort of flex its muscles the way it has been. It's just hard for me. I always that someone like Putin seems to be winning when on paper he should be losing. But I guess it sort of really speaks to the says more about his opponents than about himself. But you know, for him, it's the game is like it is for all authoritarian politicians. It's how do you stay in power? I think the big unknown is really, you know, do the Europeans save themselves in some ways from themselves? With falling Brexit, does this with the kind of migration crisis a pressure point with these kind of, you know, if Le Pen wins in France, if Beppe Grillo, the sort of anti-establishment party, takes over in Italy, then you might see this thing kind of careening out of control. And then, you know, I don't even see the U.S. being able to hold it together. And about Trump, you know, I think the war in Washington is really between, you know, the forces of normalcy and establishment, you know, the party which prefers him to Hillary Clinton and feels like they've at least won something. They have Congress, but they're also dealing with someone who is incredibly unpredictable, is not one of theirs. And, you know, are they able to tame him, or is he just untamable? Because that's who he is. He is a rebel. You know, he is someone who is got to where he is by essentially doing the opposite of what people want him to do, you know, by being a kind of iconoclast. You know, he's not really a Republican even, you know. So I think that really plays into, and I'm just kind of a long-winded way of saying how it plays into the international scene. You know, does the Trump administration become more like a kind of common, like what you expect a Republican administration to do, which is, you know, committed to international relationships, strong on NATO, supportive of Ukraine, by the way, you know, hostile to countries like Putin's Russia? Or does Trump really succeed in tearing the U.S. down as, you know, the kind of an enforcer of the current global order, and into becoming more like any other country? Because the minute the U.S. becomes more like any other country, then I think the world is in for a very difficult transition, because you're going to have this is a big jolt for all the people who are complaining about America being too strong. Wait till America's too weak. And that's not going to be a very pretty I think picture. And, you know, with the consequences ranging from economic, political disruption to possibly, you know, conflict because that's always been the case in the last 150 years. When you had an order collapse, it's collapsed with the cost being almost unimaginable.
Do we have time for one more quick question? You talked about the
what
potentially can happen within the United States. Let's look at Russia. As you said, Russia shouldn't be as strong as it is. This week, one of Putin's opponents was arrested on seemingly trumped up charges. Do you see any potential for change within the Russian Federation as the one of the factors that will play into how the international scene changes? I mean, I don't see pressure on Putin externally changing things, but I see pressure from within potentially changing things. Is that something that you would put into the mix?
I would certainly. I guess the one thing we've sort of learned from history is that the regimes that seem to be the most stable because they're the most rigid and the least free are the ones that are the most unstable at the end of the day. They can, any moment they could kind of collapse. I guess we just, from the outside, Putin seems in a much better place than he did 5 years ago when there were, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in the street over there. There's a real threat to him. He had no popular legitimacy and he had no story to tell. Now his story is, you know, I revived Great Russia, and he does seem to have what seems almost like genuine support behind him. But I, you know, it's a system that's not a normal system. It's a system where you have, it's run like a kind of organized crime family in part. There's really no, there's sort of none of the typical kind of safety valves that you have in, you know, normal countries, either for public frustration or for grappling with kind of elite conflict. And so it seems that sort of Putin is probably more vulnerable than we think he is. I mean, he certainly seems to think he's vulnerable. I mean, his behavior suggests that he thinks he's very vulnerable. And this is why he's doing all the things that he's doing, including rebuilding the military and kind of turning the West into an enemy. But I'm not necessarily sure that if you were to replace Putin today, you would get a better alternative to him. And I kind of do worry that because his survival, any human beings, right, is at the top of his mind. So he knows that if he falls, he's probably dead. So he's probably willing to do anything that it takes to stay in power. I mean, it's hard to imagine Putin sort of, you know, one day retiring to his villa
in
the Riviera, right? So some external pressure might help, but a kind of maybe more savvy use of, I mean, the West it's in a remarkable situation where we have Russia and China, which are, you know, China's a growing economy, but it's still a relatively weak power, but Russia has aging nuclear weapons, but really has a fairly weak hand to play. It's got no allies, really. It's got very little to offer. It has sort of has the economy of a third world country, you know, dependent on just a sort of kind of on a single commodity, or two, oil and gas. But it's playing a kind of, you know, the hand of a rising regional, if not global, power. And that's because we've let it. And that's not just on Trump. It's really more on Obama before, and, you know, where vacuums were created, the Russians are moving in. I had a better sense that there was a real threat, imminent threat to Putin before, but I think we just don't really know. You know, no one really, in 1987, 88, no one would have predicted that the Soviet Union would fall apart.
Precisely. Or that it would have held together. At times we thought it would fall apart, it didn't. So we're living, I suppose this is an obvious statement, we're living in uncertain times, but you've laid out a number of the factors to watch. So thank you very much for finding the time. Was there anything else that you wanted to maybe add that I haven't asked?
No, thank you, Marta. It's good to talk to you.
Matt, thank you so much for this. And perhaps next time we can talk about China, because I think that's the place we're not paying attention to that perhaps we should be.
So absolutely.
Look forward to reading more of your things, and I'll send you a link to the interview. Thank you very much.
Great.
We've been speaking with Matthew Kaminski, the managing editor of Politico Europe in Brussels.
It was the 20th annual Ukraine Fashion Week this week. Designers showed their collections to Kyiv's glitterati in the Grand Mestetsky Arsenal art space. Those who could not attend in person were encouraged to follow the five-day extravaganza online, and Ukraine Calling listeners can check out the photos. In other cultural news, a Ukrainian, Oksana Liniu, became the main conductor of Austria's Graz Philharmonic Orchestra. It is the first time in 150 years that a woman has been selected to this position, and the first time it's a Ukrainian. For your musical pleasure, here's a contemporary song for you called Talk to Me, Поговори зі мною. The lyrics and music were composed by the talented Kristina Golovko and Oleg Timoshek, the Lviv group Piano. It premiered on my weekly music show Pora Roku. Enjoy. Tune in next week for a new episode, and we'd love to hear from you. Write to us at ukrainecalling@gromadskeradio.org. I'm Andrei Kulikov for Gromadske Radio in Kyiv. Thanks for listening.